Hello, and welcome to Motion Martial Arts' second podcast. In this episode, I'm going to share two interviews that I conducted last September with two martial artists who were very practical in their approach to karate. The first is Ian Abernethy, who to many in the karate community will need no introduction. He's a guy who's been at the forefront of the practical karate movement for a while now, and I would very much suggest his work to anyone that is interested in make their training a bit more practical. The second is a friend of mine named Andy Allen, who I actually met several years ago at another of Ian's seminars, who is a high school teacher in Nova Scotia. And the karate program that he teaches at that high school is very practical in its approach and something I think would be interesting to many of the practitioners and teachers out there. So I hope that you enjoy both of these interviews. Hello, my name is Daniel Marino, and this is Motion Martial Arts. Today I'm here with Ian Abernethy in Burlington, Ontario, and he was kind enough to agree to an interview with me about one of my favorite podcasts of his titled Karate 3.0. So real quick, what we're going to do is we're just going to go over some of the key points that he brings up in that podcast, and I'm going to get a little bit of extra information about them, and hopefully in a way that will encourage any listeners maybe to check that podcast out. So thank you for being here.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Yep. Yeah. So the first point you bring up in the summary, Karate 3.0 podcast, is the acceptance of modern bunkai, modern applications, as the applications.
Yeah.
So, and it's something I've definitely run into a lot, you know, especially online, that when you talk to people that they'll say, yeah, well, what you're doing may be fine and all, but it's not...
Is it authentic or original?
Exactly. Yeah. If you could just kind of...
Yeah, well, I think the first thing is what those authentic original applications were and are now lost to us. We've got the forms, we've got the guidance from the old masters on how the form should work, and all of that's very useful, but we don't have a guidebook passed from them. So, and the danger is as well, as we've tried to kind of look at these our arts and analyse them, is we get stuck in this analysis paralysis, where every time we teach a movement, we go, well, it could be this, it could be that, it could be the other. So the point I wanted to make in the podcast was, I think every dojo or school should say, well, for us, this is the application. Now, the dojo down the road may have another one, but for us, this is what it is, and therefore we've got something solid and concrete, and we've got a workable system that we can run with, just like the old masters did. Irrelevance, really, whether they're doing specifically exactly the same as us, so long as it's the same in intent, we're fine. Functional intent is what we want.
Yeah, I mean, as I've heard you say many times before, you know, function should be
the ultimate measure.
Yeah,
that's
number
right.
One thing we use to measure our methods. So the second point brought was, you know, just being practical in all that we do.
Yeah.
Practical training across the board. I thought you had a really interesting kind of approach to what you mean by practicality.
So practical means it gets the results that we want. It gets real world results. So if we're talking about self-defense, it needs to be practical. If we're talking about winning point tournaments, it needs to be practical. If we're looking at getting someone fit and healthy and enjoying it, then it needs to achieve those aims. Okay. So I think if we're very concrete and clear on what our aims are, then we can achieve and train for those aims. We're not just training with a vague idea of what we want to get from it.
Yeah.
So, and as part of that is everything we do, we should try and make it sure it's measurable. We've got a way of testing if we're achieving the results
Absolutely.
That we want or not.
Yeah, and it's, you know, often when people say practical, people immediately will think self-defense
type
training. But I think it's a really cool idea that it's practical in everything we do. You know, we can be practical about practicing, you know, sporting methods for martial arts, as long as we define that we are practicing a sporting method.
And if people come along to get a bit of exercise and enjoy it, then it should achieve those things. So it should make them fit and healthy and make them have fun. Yeah, so measure everything by effect.
Which actually goes right into the next point pretty well, which is defining context in our training.
So I still think this is the biggest problem in modern martial arts, is people don't define what they're training for. So if we're training for self-defense and we need to look at what real world violence is like and then train accordingly, if we're training for a sport, then that's fine, it's a good thing to do, and it's enjoyable and exciting and fun, but we need to clearly demarcate, this is what we're training for, this is the objective in this given moment. So and not getting the context confused. When I went to the judo club, they were very clear their aim is to win judo tournaments. They didn't have that kind of almost like schizophrenia that karate can somehow have, where it's not sure if it's a traditional art, it's a self-defense system, or it's a sport. So just define it, and then we're good to go.
Okay. And number four would be, accept that change is a traditional part of the martial arts and that it's vital to the martial arts.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
You know.
Well, that's it. Like Funakoshi, regarded as a father of modern karate, says, times change, the world changes, and martial arts must change too. Chibana said about how karate was like a pond, that if it's not fed by fresh water from streams, it goes stagnant and die. Yeah. You know, there's always this idea that things should change. So if we can find a better, more functional way of doing things, we shouldn't stick with it for tradition, because the tradition, the true tradition, has always been one of innovation and constant improvement, and we should never abandon that. We need to make sure we're doing that.
Okay, and on the number five would be the end of style limitations.
Yeah, yeah. So, and again, I think that becomes a false measure which goes against the practicality. So people go, yeah, that works. It's functional. It achieves the objective, but it's not my style. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
So, and I think this idea of the style becoming an end in itself, trying to preserve something in amber, is antithetical to practicality. It's also antithetical to tradition. And ironically, it's not what the old masters did. They never did that. They were, again, constant seeking, constant improvement. So if you find something that you think's good, then you bring it into your training. You should make use of it. The style should never be a limiter.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so number six would be, and this is actually one of my favorite points that you brought up in the course of the podcast, one I think is really key, especially with the way karate is typically practiced today, is the promotion of karate as a lifelong journey.
Yeah, yeah. So it is, I think this is something that karate and related disciplines have, it's a strength of the art, is that we have a version that kids can do for fun, enjoyment, health, fitness, discipline. We've got a version that teenagers and 20-somethings can do. You know, I'm competing, I'm winning tournaments, I'm knocking people out, I'm submitting people in a cage, whatever it is they want to do. Then you move into your 30s or 40s, and maybe your body can't do that anymore, but now you've got a family, and you've got property, and you've got things you want to protect, or maybe the self-defense element becomes more important to you.
Yeah.
And then as you get older, middle-aged guy, it's about like fitness and health, you know what I mean? So as we move through, the emphasis may shift, and I think that we should emphasize that there's not one ideal way. 40-something guys should not be telling 20-something guys how to do karate. They've got a karate that fits their age range and what they want to do. So,
yeah, you know, as somebody that I think it's safe to say that, you know, majority of people in modern days, you know, start karate as children. I was 9 years old when I started.
Yeah, 11
pretty
for
typical,
me, yeah, yeah.
You know, often younger, honestly. And, you know, it's kind of ridiculous to think of karate as a single thing when you're having people as young as 6 years old and, you know, as old as... You know, take it to with you to the end of your life. I think that's really something that a lot of people could benefit from, looking at it as that it's like something that you start, and not so different from other sports and stuff. Like, you know, how often do you have, you know, a professional baseball player who didn't, you know, start playing, you know, before until after he was a child?
Yeah,
you know, probably pretty rare, but it's something you might start as a child and you bring it with you for the rest of your life, and, you know, the focus of your training, of course, will change, you know, as you grow and change as a person. So
yeah, and all of it's valid as well. That's a key thing, because we have a bad habit of viewing the bit that we're doing at the moment as being the only valid bit. So the 20-something guys, it's competition's all that matters, and then the 40-something guy, it's self-defense all that matters, and the older guy, no, it's keep yourself fit and healthy is all that matters. You know, it's just acknowledging that the different things matter to different parts of our lifelong journey, and if we do karate right, it can help us on all of those, you know.
All right, and the seventh point was embracing karate's true history rather than its cherished myths.
Yeah, well, I think that's another one is, you know, like, for example, you know, the Zen link has been well defunct, the Shaolin temple thing, the idea that there were unarmed peasants rising up against their samurai overlords, you know, there's all these kind of myths that karate has that we feel... some people anyway feel very attached to. I think we're far better getting rid of those and understanding why they were told and what purpose those false information and what the purpose it was supposed to serve. But we're far better getting back the true history. It's way more interesting.
And then it goes right into kind of another last point, and a very related one, is the end of deification of sensei.
I think, you know, there's, and that's a big one in terms of both the past masters. I mean, so the two common mistakes you make is the past masters were infallible and could do no wrong, or you got the other extreme that they were useless know-nothings who couldn't get anything right, you know. And the truth is somewhere between the two. You know, karate hasn't reached a state of perfection, so we shouldn't deify the masters at that point. And more importantly, when people are training with the other people today, it's an acknowledgement that this guy may be able to get me fitter and he may be a better fighter, but he may not be an ideal life guru. And I think there's that danger of that deification. Or plenty of karate instructors who've failed businesses and failed relationships and all this kind of, you know, just because they're good at punching people in the head doesn't mean you should turn your life over to them, you know, like the wise old Sifus in kung fu movies, you know.
That's a point of something that I've thought about quite a bit, actually. And, you know, to tell you the truth, my impression is that martial arts often has almost like a pseudo like religious feel to it, the way that it's practiced very often, that, you know, people treat it almost like their style and the way that they were taught. It's like, you know, well, it's a sacred thing.
It has all the trappings of religion as well, because, you know, like you say, they have a they have the dogmas, and then they have a hierarchy, and they have, you know, it has all the trappings of it, and we've got to avoid that, I think. And that doesn't mean, you know, if you can get an instructor who's a good guy, and you can but you can take, I mean, I have instructors that I've listened to about medical things, but not because they're instructors, it's because they're doctors. You know what I mean? It's that kind of thing. So it's not just because he happens to be good at teaching martial arts doesn't mean he's good at absolutely everything else. So we just look at, you know, people as people, and I think that's better for student and teacher, I think.
And treating martial arts like religion, you know, at the end of the day, I think doesn't do anybody any favors. Certainly doesn't do any favors for, you know, approaching it from a practical standpoint or anything like that. It becomes something that has a meaning that people almost can't define, that we have to do it this way because it's sacred to them. And I think that does hold back a lot, large portion of the martial arts community.
Yeah, well, and there's a comfort in feeling, I know it all, I know what it's supposed to be, I know it's supposed to work, and there's a hierarchy and an order, but it's false. You know, we need to be a bit more open and free-flowing, and I think that's better for everybody involved in it, I think.
Okay, and the kind of final statement that you had a little at the end of the podcast was just that, you know, your purpose, you know, with the way that you practice, the way that you teach, is just you want karate to be evolving in a healthy direction, which I think is important, you know, for me. I'm a teacher myself, of course, that for everybody that, you know, is a part of this martial arts community, we're teaching martial arts, we have students of our own, you know, that we should be thinking about the direction that karate should be going right now. So
we want to have a version of karate that the past masters would be proud of. They would look at us and go, you know, good job, you took what we gave you and you ran with it. And we also want one that the future generations will be excited about practicing as well. You know, we need to be effective in that link, and hopefully if we all pull in that direction, then, you know, martial arts and karate specifically will be better for that.
Okay, great. Well, I think that sums up Karate 3.0 pretty well. And thank you very much for your time. Thanks for teaching another wonderful seminar here this weekend.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Hello, I'm here the second day of a seminar in Burlington, Ontario with Ian Abernethy, and I'm speaking to a martial artist I've met previously before. I follow his work online. I like the stuff that he does very much. So, Andy, thank you very much for being here.
All right, thanks for having me, Daniel.
So,
just want to apologize in advance. I'm fighting a bit of a head cold, so if I sound a bit muffled, or do the best I can to be audible.
So Andy is a high school teacher in Nova Scotia, and he teaches a karate program there, and I followed the stuff that he's done. I like it very much. I like just seeing, you know, karate being taught in schools in general, especially the kind of karate that he teaches and the stuff that he does. So if you could just a little bit talk about your program.
Yeah, I started teaching the course and first of all, this is it's a high school credit course. So in Nova Scotia, Canada, where I'm from, every high school graduate must have a physical education credit to graduate. And in my school in particular, there's many courses to choose from. You can choose your typical phys ed class or something called PAL, which is kind of like a phys ed for non-jocks. It's organized games and stuff. You can take dance, yoga, something called fitness leadership, or finally martial arts. And that's what I do. I started the course, the course kind of fell on my principal's lap. It was a locally developed course, which means it wasn't part of the provincial set of curricula. And he ran at that, knew I was heavily into karate, and offered me the opportunity to teach it the next year. So I jumped on the opportunity. That was 2005. I've been teaching ever since. And this year, in fact, half of my teaching load is actually martial arts. I started out teaching sciences, so I have couple of different biology courses I take, and the other half this year is martial arts. When I started in 2005, it was a lot different than what I do now. So coming from a Shotokan background, it was heavily based in 3K, your kata, ki, and kumite. And that's the way I started out. But now it's very much practically based. There's a big movement globally, in particular in the UK with Ian Abernethy and others, to make karate meaningful, bring back the old ways, as the karate culture guys say. So I encountered one of Ian's videos a number of years ago. I think it was a hand go down video, the opening movements where you're kind of smashing on an arm and a neck and cranking necks, and I thought, I kind of like that. It resonated with me because for years marched up and down the dojo, and no disrespect to my sensei, because I learned a lot from my sensei. He's technically masterful, has an absolute wonderful control of his own body, and for someone who's actually self-taught, absolutely amazing basics, amazing kata. And so I went through that kind of program, but I needed some more grit. I noticed from that kind of training, I was very good at distance with a competitive kind of background, but from a self-defense aspect, I was sorely lacking. So anyways, I started watching more of Ian's videos, later on Patrick McCarthy's work as well, and it kata made sense. It was more than just a choreographed dance, but having no grappling background, it was a very slow learning process for me, because I was basically learning from videos and trying things without my students. So today, the school program, we just started a new semester this month. I've got 32 15-year-old kids in my class, and we are about 4 weeks in now, and they've learned the first 17 movements of Heian Shoden, which is the first kata. We've done some bunkai, some application. They're learning a little bit of throwing, some chokes, some arm locks, some groundwork, and the program has really taken off. Like I said, there's half my teaching load is martial arts this year. Almost all the kids love it. And what I find gratifying now, other than just taking a fresh group of students who come from usually nothing in terms of martial arts background, 5 months later, end of the semester, they can throw punches and kicks, they can hit some pads with impact, they know some clinch work, they can do some throws, they teach a bit of groundwork as well, because I've been doing a bit of jiu-jitsu to kind of supplement my training. So they go from nothing to be, you know, fairly capable of taking care of themselves. And I also run a non-profit karate club, which is at the rec center attached to our high school, and the majority of my students are in the evening dojo are my high school students. So it's to have the opportunity to get paid for what I love is absolutely priceless, because I there's never a day I walk into the school gym and not want to be there. I get excited, and the kids get excited, because excitement, of course, is contagious, and it's just an absolute ball. I love it.
Yeah, that's something I actually really like to see. That I've said for years that, you know, self-defense is the kind of thing that should be taught in schools.
Absolutely.
So specifically, not just that they're learning karate, learning a traditional martial art, which is great too, but that has a specific, that I see, you know, the things that you post online, there's a specific focus on self-defense. I think that's great. You know, I think we need to treat self-defense training as more like, you know, like first aid training, or just, you know, like the kind of thing that everybody can benefit from it, and everybody should have it. So,
absolutely.
You know, I'd hope that people would take, you know, kind of look at what you're doing, and, you know, other karate practitioners out there, especially maybe if they're a high school teacher like yourself, yeah, they might take that and, you know, look at something that they might want to introduce into their own communities that I think could really benefit everybody.
Yeah, there's a friend of mine, actually, his name is Jake Crawford, went through the years of training with Shotokan, with Jake as well. He's a good friend of mine. He helps me teach at my dojo. He also has been teaching this martial arts program in his high school as well. He's also a high school teacher. So, and there's another person that used to teach it as well nearby. So in Nova Scotia, it's actually, in a few schools at least, it's part of the curriculum. And I believe there's still a guy in Truro who does the same thing, only with judo. So it's an absolute wonderful part of the school experience, but of course it's a very specialized teaching role, and you have to have the teacher with that kind of background.
Cool. All right, well, I think that about wraps it up. Yeah, Andy, thanks a lot for talking to me. Appreciate it very much.
Yep.
Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed both of those interviews. Next podcast will be about conceptual learning, and we'll be with my friend Dave Grossman again, and a friend and training partner of his will be joining us. So expect that one in the next couple of weeks. Thanks.